It's Thursday, September 20th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm David Byrd in Washington. Coming up, North and South Korea agree to dismantle a nuclear facility, but will that lead to real change?
I see that essentially Kim is going to try to play for more time, because at this particular moment, he's getting everything that he wants.
Also ahead, the State Department releases its annual report on terrorism. The Senate Judiciary Committee won't budge on a hearing for Supreme Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh's accuser. President Trump visits flood-damaged areas, and Facebook helps make birthdays a time to give. It's all on today's International Edition. U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo has welcomed what he called the important commitments made by North Korean leader Kim Jong-un at a summit with his South Korean counterpart this week. North Korea announced it would disassemble a nuclear weapons complex if the United States takes corresponding measures under a comprehensive agreement reached by the leaders of the two rival Koreas. Pompeo said Wednesday that he had invited North Korean Foreign Minister Ri Yong-ho to meet with him in New York at next week's United Nations General Assembly. He also said Pyongyang's representatives have been invited to hold talks with the U.S. Special Envoy for North Korea in Austria at the earliest opportunity. In a statement, Pompeo said this will mark the beginning of negotiations to transform U.S.-DPRK relations through the process of rapid denuclearization of North Korea, to be completed by January of 2021, as committed to by Chairman Kim, and to construct a lasting and stable peace regime on the Korean Peninsula. At the end of their three-day summit, Kim and South Korean President Moon Jae-in announced that Pyongyang had agreed to close the Yongbyong facility, coupled with a pledge to permanently shut down its missile engine testing facility and launch pad under the watchful eye of international experts. "We have agreed to make the Korean Peninsula a land of peace, free from nuclear weapons and nuclear threats," Kim told reporters during the joint announcement with President Moon. For some perspective on that agreement, VOA's Ira Melman spoke with Asia expert Gordon Chang, the author of Nuclear Showdown, North Korea Takes on the World.
Gordon, are you as seemingly as gleeful about this North-South Korea summit statement as is President Trump?
Maybe a little bit less gleeful. I think that it's important to give Kim Jong-un that one-shot opportunity that President Trump talked about in June before the Singapore summit. I think that Kim Jong-un deserves that chance to do the right thing. But today we have not heard anything from Kim that indicates that he has made a fundamental decision to give up his nuclear weapons and his ballistic missiles. He's made some gestures. That's a good sign. That is progress. But we need to see much more, especially at this stage of the discussions.
It has been questioned as to whether or not some of the agreements dealing with the two Koreas that have been reached or nearly reached by the presidents of North and South Korea might go against U.S. and U.N. sanctions. What do you have to say about that?
Well, clearly Moon wants to shovel money into the coffers of Kim Jong-un. I mean, they talked about all sorts of joint projects, especially the railroads. This is going to be something that won't make any progress at all until those sanctions by the UN are lifted and until the U.S. also lifts its measures. I think that this was sort of just aspiration on both the part of Seoul and Pyongyang. And really, Moon Jae-in, the South Korean president, understands they're not going to make progress on these joint economic projects until North Korea gives up its weapons.
It seems that you're doing something you haven't done much before, and that is giving a little credence to what this meeting has done, that maybe some progress has been made.
Well, yeah, of course, gestures are progress. But what we really want to see are steps on the part of Kim Jong-un to give up his nuclear weapons and his ballistic missiles. And that's absolutely critical. He's going to have to do some things that he's been unwilling to do. And I think one of the important things today is something that was not said. Kim Jong-un did not make a promise to make a declaration of his missile and nuke sites. And that's got to be the starting point of a long series of negotiations with Pyongyang. We haven't even gotten there yet.
Is this more of the same we've been hearing now for a long time?
this could be more of the same. We won't really know for a little while. We do know that Kim Jong-un is a little bit different than his father and grandfather, his predecessors, and we also know he's under pressure internally to deliver prosperity. He's under pressure from the poorest North Koreans and under pressure from the Dongju, the new moneyed class. So there are reasons why Kim might make decisions that haven't been made by his father and grandfather, but this is something that we're just going to have to test him. And on the part of the United States, it's going to be how much pressure are we willing to apply to North Korea and its sponsors, Russia, China, and increasingly South Korea. So this is more, I think, a question of what the U.S. is willing to do rather than the question of what the North Koreans and its sponsors are willing to do.
Where do you see this going now?
I see that essentially Kim is going to try to play for more time, because at this particular moment, he's getting everything that he wants, a sanctions relief, getting support from the Chinese and the Russians and the South Koreans. He may not get all that he wants in terms of sanctions relief, but he's getting all that he needs. And that means that he's been recalcitrant on making the big decisions of giving up his nukes and his missiles. So I see that essentially a couple months from now, President Trump is going to have to pivot again, go back to maximum pressure, maybe even going back to threats. So this is going to get more, there's going to be more friction before there's more sweetness and light.
That's Asia expert Gordon Chang speaking with VOA's Ira Melman. Kim Jong-un and South Korean President Moon Jae-in are visiting a volcano the North considers sacred on the last day of Moon's visit. South Korean officials said today that Moon traveled by plane to an airport near Mount Paektu, where Kim had arrived first to greet him. Moon returns to South Korea later today. Among the top stories in the world, Pompeo says U.S. ready to restart talks with North Korea. U.S. official says Islamic State and Al-Qaeda are determined and adaptable. Senator pushes woman accusing Kavanaugh of assault to testify. Trump visits hurricane-ravaged Carolinas. And a report says extreme poverty is declining worldwide. Expanded coverage of these stories and more is on the voanews.com website and on our mobile app. This is International Edition. Thanks for being with us. I'm David Byrd in Washington. U.S. counterterrorism officials say that despite major strides in combating and regaining territory from terror groups like Islamic State and Al-Qaeda, the terror landscape has grown more complex. U.S. Coordinator for Counterterrorism Nathan Sales said Wednesday that terrorism attacks last year tended to be concentrated in just a few areas.
Although terrorist attacks took place in 100 countries in 2017, they were concentrated geographically. 59% of all attacks took place in five countries. Those are Afghanistan, India, Iraq, Pakistan, and the Philippines. Similarly, 70% of all deaths due to terrorist attacks took place in five countries. And those are Afghanistan, Iraq, Nigeria, Somalia, and Syria.
Sales made those comments in a briefing to reporters on the release of the State Department's 2017 Country Reports on Terrorism, which found that Islamic State and Al-Qaeda have become more dispersed, turning to the Internet to inspire attacks by distant followers, and that makes them less susceptible to conventional military action. Sales said that even as Islamic State lost territory last year, it continued to shift away from a centralized command and encouraged its sympathizers around the world to use whatever weapons they have at hand against so-called soft targets.
ISIS, Al-Qaeda, and their affiliates have proven to be resilient, determined, and adaptable. They have adjusted to heightened counterterrorism pressure in Iraq, Syria, Somalia, and elsewhere. Foreign terrorist fighters are heading home from the war zone in Iraq and Syria, or traveling to third countries to join ISIS branches there. We also are experiencing an increase in attacks by homegrown terrorists, that is, people who have been inspired by ISIS but have never set foot in Syria or Iraq. We've seen ISIS-directed or ISIS-inspired attacks outside the war zone on soft targets and in public spaces like hotels, tourist resorts, and cultural sites.
While terror groups have become more resilient, Sales noted progress in the fight with the United States and its allies working to expand information security, improve aviation security, and enhance law enforcement capabilities. The U.S. counterterrorism officials said the coalition has succeeded in liberating nearly all the territory that Islamic State fighters once held in Iraq and Syria and has increased pressure on al-Qaeda.
99% of the territory ISIS once held in Iraq and Syria has now been liberated. Approximately 50% of those gains were achieved since January of 2017. Similarly, more than 7.7 million people have been liberated from ISIS's brutal role, approximately 4.5 million in Iraq and 3.2 million in Syria. Of those 7.7 million people, an estimated 5 million have been liberated since 2017.
Last year also saw the total number of terrorist attacks worldwide decrease by 23%, and the total number of deaths caused by terrorism decreased by 27%. Nathan Sales said the main reason for that decrease is that the number of terrorist attacks and resulting deaths plummeted in Iraq. Still, he says there is one country that leads others in supporting terrorism.
The threats posed by Iran's support for terrorism are not confined to the Middle East. They are truly global. Since 2012 alone, Hezbollah has conducted a successful attack in Bulgaria that killed six. It has undertaken two separate plots in Cyprus, and it has developed large caches of military equipment and explosives in Kuwait, Nigeria, and Bolivia, while sending terrorist operatives to Peru and Thailand.
Nathan Sales also noted that while al-Qaeda has not been in the spotlight as much as in the past, the terror group has been expanding its numbers. In Colombia, meanwhile, Sales noted that the United States is working with the Colombian government to undermine militant groups that did not sign a peace agreement between FARC rebels and the government, including members of ELN and other organizations. U.S. President Donald Trump traveled Wednesday to the Carolinas to see firsthand the destruction left behind by Hurricane Florence and the challenging relief efforts that are underway. Shortly after arriving at the Marine Corps Air Station in Cherry Point, North Carolina, the president sought to reassure residents that the whole country will work to help them recover.
To the families who have lost loved ones, America grieves with you, and our hearts break for you. God bless you. We will never forget your loss. We will never leave your side. We're with you all the way. And to all those impacted by this terrible storm, our entire American family is with you and ready to help, and you will recover.
The president then went to the storm-ravaged town of New Bern, where he handed out meals and mingled with residents. One young volunteer even gave the president a bear hug, and Trump posed for a photograph with the young man. Florence has killed at least 37 people and left entire towns in North Carolina flooded with muddy, fetid water. Officials across the state are cautioning residents that more floods are expected this week. North Carolina Governor Roy Cooper said 16 rivers, were at major flood stage Tuesday, with three more expected to peak by today. Cooper said that despite the setbacks, though, the Tar Heel State will recover.
I know that this state has a great economy, great education. We are a beacon in the South, and we have weathered storms before in our state. But, Mr. President, we have never seen one like this. This one has been epic, it has been disastrous, and it has been widespread. It is a storm like no other.
The North Carolina governor told the president that his state will need fast-track help from federal agencies to get back on its feet.
You're here, And I'm asking you, sir, for your help every step of the way. All of these federal agencies are going to have to help us in cutting red tape and making sure we can be smart about this rebuilding process. We still understand that people have a lot of immediate needs, and that's going to be critically important over the next few days and weeks. But long-term rebuild, I know the resiliency of North Carolinians. We have an amazing state. I know that we can come back stronger than ever, but we're going to need your help, and thank you for coming to listen to this.
Trump told Cooper that the federal government will work to help the recovery effort 100%. The president sympathized with those who were forced to flee and are now relying on government-distributed bottled water and ready-to-eat field rations. Trump said that 1.6 million meals have been provided in North Carolina and another 400,000 are ready for victims in South Carolina. The president also took a short trip to Conway, South Carolina, which is just across the border. Many of the rivers that are above flood stage north of that border flow into South Carolina. The president told residents there that they can count on federal help to recover from the disaster, that whatever they need from Washington, they will get. The attorney for a woman who accuses President Donald Trump's Supreme Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh of sexually assaulting her says that multiple witnesses should be included in a Senate Judiciary Committee hearing about her allegations. Lisa Banks said Wednesday that Christine Blasey Ford has been reluctantly thrust into the public spotlight only 2 days ago. Banks said her client is not able to go home because she has been receiving ongoing threats against her and her family. Ford has accused Kavanaugh of sexually assaulting her when both were teenagers more than 35 years ago. Judiciary Committee Chairman Chuck Grassley of Iowa, meanwhile, wrote to Ford's attorneys that the hearing was still scheduled for Monday morning. He pointedly said that Ford must submit her written statement by 10 o'clock Friday if she intends to testify. As VOA's Jim Malone reports, President Donald Trump is standing by Kavanaugh as the controversy comes just weeks before pivotal midterm elections.
President Trump is standing by his Supreme Court nominee, Judge Brett Kavanaugh.
This is a very tough thing for him and his family, and we want to get it over with. At the same time, we want to give tremendous amounts of time. If she shows up, that would be wonderful. If she doesn't show up, that would be unfortunate.
Professor Christine Blasey Ford has been invited to testify Monday before the Senate Judiciary Committee. But Ford first wants the FBI to investigate her allegation that Kavanaugh sexually assaulted her when they were teenagers in the 1980s. Ford has the support from Senate Democrats, including Kirsten Gillibrand of New York.
The fact that she has to protect her children from death threats and this kind of assertions online about her, I think is exactly why survivors of sexual violence do not come forward.
Law professor Anita Hill is also among those calling for a full investigation. In 1991, Hill accused then Supreme Court nominee Clarence Thomas of sexual misconduct, though Thomas was eventually confirmed by a narrow margin.
There is no reason for them to rush this and push this in with a 6-day time frame. The American public really is expecting something more. The American public wants to know about what happened, and they want to know that the Senate takes this seriously.
Republicans have complained that the Ford allegation came after lengthy and contentious hearings where Kavanaugh was questioned by senators from both parties. South Dakota Republican Senator John Thune.
There have been 1,300 written questions that have been responded to by Judge Kavanaugh, and he met with 65 United States senators over the course of the last 2 months, and never a whiff of this letter until just this last week.
Republican Senator Lisa Murkowski says it's important that both Ford and Kavanaugh be heard.
My hope is that it will be conducted with a level of respect and integrity for the process and for the people.
You believe the allegations are credible?
I think that is exactly why we have this process.
The controversy has now put Kavanaugh's nomination, a lifetime appointment to the Supreme Court, in jeopardy, says legal analyst Paul Schiff Berman.
And I think that this accusation will solidify the Democratic opposition to Kavanaugh's nomination. And given the fact that Republicans hold only a small majority in the Senate, the defection of just a small number of Republican senators would defeat this nomination.
Kavanaugh was nominated to replace retired Justice Anthony Kennedy. His confirmation would solidify a conservative majority on the Supreme Court. Jim Malone, VOA News, Washington.
Late Wednesday, a key Democrat, Missouri Senator Claire McCaskill, announced that she would vote against Kavanaugh, depriving President Trump's nominee of a possible swing vote. McCaskill is the first of five undecided Senate Democrats in competitive re-election races to come out against the nominee. Her decision had been awaited by those watching her close re-election battle with Republican Missouri Attorney General Josh Hawley, who has urged Kavanaugh's swift confirmation. You're listening to International Edition. This is VOA.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of VOA's Encounter. Join me and two advocates from the world of politics, public policy, or academia, debating critical and controversial issues of our day, bringing depth, perspective, and insight to the world around us. That's Encounter, every Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.
I'm Victor Beatty. Since 1942, The Voice of America has been a consistently reliable and authoritative source of news. Today, VOA remains committed to providing an accurate, objective, and comprehensive news product at the top of every hour, every day. We can be heard on your local affiliate or streamed on the web at voanews.com.
This is VOA's International Edition. I'm David Byrd in Washington. U2 frontman Bono met with Pope Francis at the Vatican Wednesday and described the pontiff as being aghast at the sexual abuse scandal in the Catholic Church. The Irish singer met with the Pope privately at the Vatican Hotel, where the pontiff lives, to discuss themes including what Bono called the wild beast that is capitalism and sustainable development.
We discussed the macro and the micro, the local community level changes that have to happen, and then the sort of macro with commerce and how, you know, we have to rethink the wild beast that is capitalism and how, though it's not immoral, it is amoral.
Bono said that because Francis visited Ireland recently, they spoke about the pontiff's feelings about what has happened in the church. The Irish Church's reputation has been stained by cases of pedophile priests and systematic abuse cover-ups.
I explained how, you know, it looks to some people like the abusers are being more protected than the victims, and you can see the pain in his face, and I felt he was sincere.
During his trip to Ireland, the Pope had begged forgiveness for multiple abuses suffered by Irish Catholics over the decades. Years of sexual abuse scandals have shattered the credibility of the Church, which four decades ago dominated Irish society. In the past 3 years, Irish voters have approved abortion and gay marriage in referendums in defiance of the Vatican. Wednesday's 30-minute meeting was also to team up the rock star's One organization, a global campaign and advocacy organization that aims to end poverty, with a papal group named Scolas Occorrentes, which helps foster cooperation amongst schools worldwide. Also Wednesday, Catholic bishops in the United States said they plan to set up a hotline to field complaints about bishops who have sexually abused or harassed children or adults in response to a growing sexual misconduct scandal in the church's highest ranks. The hotline was one of several moves unveiled Wednesday by bishops who were trying to rebuild trust in the U.S. church hierarchy after recent allegations that bishops had abused children and covered up decades of sex crimes by priests. Facebook has always been a convenient way to send birthday wishes to friends, but many users have started taking advantage of a new feature introduced a year ago by the popular social networking site to turn birthday wishes into donations to help a favorite cause. And it's turned into a huge success for charities. As Michelle Quinn reports, in its first year, Facebook's birthday fundraiser feature raised more than $300 million for charities around the world.
Dan Jensen loves working as a volunteer, helping injured sea lions at the Marine Mammal Center in Northern California. He loves it so much that when his 65th birthday came around, he turned to his 1,400 Facebook friends to help raise money for the center.
Well, I should do something useful for my birthday, not just get good wishes. So I set a goal of $500 because I thought, you know, why not? And I hit the mark after a day or two, so I ended up with $2,300. It surpassed my wildest dreams.
Jensen used a relatively new feature on Facebook that makes it easy to invite friends and family to donate to the birthday celebrant's special cause. Jensen let his donors know they made a difference.
And so I said, you've bought a ton of fish. You're feeding all the animals we have on site for several days.
Facebook has been under scrutiny recently over how its services are used to spread hate or influence foreign elections. But its birthday fundraiser feature shows the power of using social media for good, says Facebook spokeswoman Royal Winner.
And what's really exciting about this is in the one short year that birthday fundraisers have been out there, over $300 million has been raised for nonprofits.
And the birthday fundraisers are having a big impact.
We've heard from a lot of nonprofits that this has really changed the way that they're doing fundraising. Whereas before, organizations would have to host a big gala or have high overhead in doing a big fundraising campaign or letter writing campaign.
Beynush Bebzani turned 35 recently. She used her birthday to ask friends to donate to a cause she cares about deeply, helping people who need bone marrow transplants. She herself received a bone marrow transplant from her brother.
And so it's not that my body was making cancerous cells, it was that my body was making no cells. So think about the boy in the bubble with, you know, I had to be isolated. I didn't have an immune system to protect me.
So she set up a Facebook request asking her friends to make donations. Her goal, $350.
Okay. Ready? One, two, three.
Ladies and gentlemen, we have another donation.
In the days that followed, Bebzani surpassed her goal, raising more than $1,600. She tells VOA she couldn't have asked for a better birthday gift. Michelle Quinn, VOA News, San Francisco.
Don't face the camera.
The world is making progress in its efforts to lift people out of extreme poverty, but the global aspiration of eliminating such poverty by 2030 is unattainable. A World Bank report released Wednesday says the number of people living on less than $1.90 per day fell to a record low of 736 million, or 10%, in 2015. That's the latest year for which data is available. That decline was less than the 11% recorded in 2013, showing a slow but steady progress. Poverty levels dropped across the world, except in the Middle East and North Africa, where civil wars spiked the extreme poverty rate from 9.5 million people in 2013 to 18.6 million in 2015. The highest concentration of extreme poverty remained in sub-Saharan Africa with 41.1%. You've been listening to VOA's International Edition. You can find our program on our website, voanews.com. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @VOA_IE. Thanks for joining us, and thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Greg Burns. I'm David Byrd in Washington. enjoy your day.